We've seen a 20% rise in the global prison population in the last 15 years, and nearly 30 million people enter and leave prisons each year. And in the US, nearly two-thirds of released prisoners are arrested within 3 years. Reoffending rates are high in other high-income countries as well, and this is often attributed to released prisoners going to live in socioeconomically deprived neighbourhoods, with poor employment opportunities, with poor schools, with poor community groups, and high levels of antisocial behaviour and residential mobility. So there's a lot of research that suggests that neighbourhood factors predict reoffending. Amir, maybe you could start by kind of giving us a bit of background about this paper and talking about the key findings of the study.
Yeah, so there's an extensive literature looking at different types of neighborhood conditions, and they have generally found that the neighborhood factors predict reoffending rates in released prisoners. There are also some studies that have looked at individual and or family level socioeconomic status indicators, and those studies have also found associations there. But that doesn't tell us much about the causal nature of these associations. So is it the case that the socioeconomic status indicators in themselves cause individuals to reoffend, or could it be the case that certain individuals are selected into different types of neighborhoods, and that it's the selection factors that actually explain the associations observed in the studies that I just mentioned. So we wanted to use quasi-experimental research design, in this particular case, within individuals' design, which means that we studied the prisoners and compared their risk of violent reoffending with themselves across time. So during periods when they were exposed to different levels of socioeconomic status, and when they lived in different types of neighborhoods, did their risks of violent reoffending change? So that was our primary research question in this case. And what we found was that when we looked at the crude associations, we found what the previous studies had found. So prisoners who returned to impoverished areas in Sweden, they had a higher likelihood of, they had a higher risk of violent reoffending. However, when we considered individuals that had moved across different types of neighborhoods and compared them with themselves across time, we could control for all the factors that were constant within these individuals. So all of their genetic risks and all of their early childhood environments, we basically just isolated their exposures to different types of neighborhoods in adulthood. And when we did so, we didn't find that those isolated environmental effects in adulthood predicted their violent reoffending rates. So this does suggest that the selection hypothesis was the prominent explanation model for these prisoners.
Well, I think it's a fantastic piece of work. I think it's really important. I think it's important in its findings, but I also think it's important in its methodology and what it's done. And it'd be something I'd like to ask Amir about, the generalizability of it. It certainly goes against, you mentioned in your paper, it goes against influential work in the topic. And a line or a piece of line that struck out for me was you talk about other studies having inadequate controls for unmeasured confounders. And I think that's something really important that you've looked at. One thing I wanted to ask you about early on was you've used the Swedish registry, which is quite influential and famous, but I wonder if you could tell people about that. Why is that a useful database to tap into? I appreciate you're also in Sweden, which there's a reality for you in using it, but what is the strength of the Swedish registry?
So in Sweden, we have a civic registration number, and it's pretty similar to the national insurance number in the UK. The difference here is that all of the governmental agencies have access to this information, and they use it in their registers. So it's pretty straightforward for Statistics Sweden, which is the maintainer of all of these large-scale databases, to link different types of governmental agency data with one another. So in this particular case, we identified all the released prisoners from a register from the Swedish Prison and Probation Services. And using the civic registration number, then Statistics Sweden could link this information with a wide range of different census registers. So we could follow them up and see where they lived and how much money they made and how if they received any types of benefits and so on across time. And we could also link this to the National Patient Register, which includes all inpatient hospitalizations in Sweden since 1973 and all outpatient visits since 2001. So using this information, we could identify a large number of patient groups. So we had patients who suffered from psychotic disorders, but also patients diagnosed with depression, anxiety, personality disorders, and substance use disorders. And also, we were able to link this data with the National Prescribed Drug Register, which includes all the prescribed drugs in the country since 2005 and onwards. So using that information, we could link the individuals and identify those who were prescribed any antipsychotics, antidepressants, mood stabilizers, and so on. So we could study them specifically. And I also want to note that we have the base sample here is all of the released prisoners, not just those that were diagnosed with psychotic disorders. We run the main analyses on the entire population, and then we stratify the analyses across the different patient groups.
I worry about it's a topic that risks being misinterpreted, or at least I fear it does. So the issue about prisoners, about recidivism, it's journalism fodder. We're recording this in the day of a general election in the UK. It's the type of thing politicians like to talk about what do we do. And I wondered if you think, Amir, there's a danger that people could take away a message that it doesn't matter where you go after prison. That it doesn't help to put you somewhere good. So I mean, I know you don't suggest that, but I think is there a danger that people could take this away?
I think that's a really complex question. I mean, it's important, and we try to stress this in the paper in the discussion, that we've looked at a high risk population from the get go, and then we study a pretty extreme outcome as well. So given that we've found what we've found, it doesn't mean that it transfers to other outcomes as well. So it might be the case that improving the socioeconomic status of prisoners will be beneficial for other sets of outcomes. So, for instance, their victimization rates or their risk of being in different types of accidents and so on. So that might be still an influential sort of factor. But if our interest is to decrease violent crime, if these findings are replicated in other contexts, it does suggest that improving the socioeconomic status won't help as much with that specifically. But then the question is, what will it do otherwise?
Could I ask you about that too again? Because there's a question about what are we measuring and the neighborhood factors issue. So what I found very interesting is we increasingly think of mental health as a very complex interaction of genes and environment. And in psychosis work, there's a growing body of research on what are called social capital and collective effective efficacy about the neighborhood around one and how that might help or predispose one to mental illness, particularly psychosis. But that's not what you looked at with this. So with neighborhood factors, you were talking about something different.
Yeah, I mean, we looked at the neighborhood effects in two different ways in this paper. So the first approach was to look at all of the neighborhood effects, or what is usually termed in the literature as the general neighborhood effects. And by that, we mean that you look at the so-called intra-class correlations for the neighborhoods. And by that, you look at how similar two randomly selected individuals in each area would be with one another in with respect to the outcome of interest. So, for instance, if neighborhood factors were to be really important, you would assume that two randomly selected individuals in each area would be quite similar to one another. In this particular case, in the crude analysis, we found that the interclass correlation was around 4%. So that's not huge at all, but it's consistent with what other neighborhood papers have found for antisocial behaviors, etc. Not in released prisoners, though, but more generally. But the problem with this measure is that it assumes that people live in the different areas randomly, and that's not the case. So what we did to adjust this measure was to look at individuals that had moved across different types of neighborhoods. And we could then use that information to isolate the effects of the neighborhoods by removing individual level characteristics. And when we did so, we found that the neighborhood effects were not significantly different from zero across, not in the full sample and not in any of the psychiatric patient group subsamples. So what that means for your question is that an aggregate of all neighborhood factors, which will include the dimensions that you suggested with the social capital and collective efficacy, but also other factors, more physical factors or even air pollution, etc., or urbanicity and all these different types of factors, they are together, they explained less, they didn't explain any of the increased risks in violent reoffending rates in the populations that we analyzed here. But then in the second step, then we looked at a couple of specific neighborhood factors. We looked at the neighborhood income. We looked at the neighborhood proportion of welfare recipients, and also the crime rates. And when we looked at them, we found initially that they predicted violent reoffending rates. But then when we adopted this within individual research design, where we compared individuals with themselves across time, we found that during periods when they were exposed to more deprived type areas, they didn't have an increased risk of reoffending compared to themselves during periods when they lived in relatively affluent areas.
So if you look at the commentary that Lewis Appleby and colleagues wrote on the Sina Fazel paper that was published in The Lancet Psychiatry a couple of years ago, which you cite in your introduction, it's all about focusing on treating mental illness, treating substance use disorders, but also addressing these wider socioeconomic factors. And this obviously suggests that we need to rethink that slightly. Or does it? I mean, how would you interpret this? Do you think it has that significant an impact on that overall expert view of minimizing reoffending risk and violent risk?
I mean, like I said, we need to replicate these findings across different contexts to see how well they hold up to different types of more policy conditions. In this particular case, if this holds, in other countries, such as the UK, it would suggest that changing the socioeconomic status of the prisoners wouldn't help as much with their reoffending rates. It might help with other factors that are important, but if the main aim is to decrease violent crime, these findings suggest that we won't get far by addressing the socioeconomic status factors.
Yeah. And there's a broader question that I had, which is about how we stigmatize people who commit violent crime. I wonder if anti-stigma programs in the UK and elsewhere are actually inadvertently stigmatizing people who commit violent crime by suggesting that they don't commit violent crime.
So I have two different ideas for that. The first idea, what I would say is that if you look at the lifetime prevalence rates of a violent crime conviction in Sweden, in healthy controls is around 3%, and bipolar disorder is around 11%, and in schizophrenia is around 1 in 4. So there are these clear differences. And then the question is, how do we understand this and so on? But to suggest that there are no differences between the patient groups and the in the controls is just inaccurate. Poor people are being viewed as having a lot of different problems inherent in themselves. So if poverty causes all of these problems that that sociologists and other people concentrate on, then you can get the impression that that poor people have this have these different types of problem inherent in themselves. So in one of our papers, when we looked at neighbor deprivation on adolescent violent crime and substance misuse, we looked at the types of neighborhoods that they grew up in, and the violent crime conviction rate was around 5% in the most deprived areas, and it was around 0.8% in the most affluent areas. So the relative differences there are important, but in absolute numbers, it's still quite low.
The paper spoke to me not just of the findings, but of the methods, and especially if we think about the contrast and findings you have to other papers. I think there's a broader message about study design and about confounders. I wonder if you had any particular thoughts on how you did it, the strengths of it. I think it's a really well-designed study. It's one of the things I like most about it. But I wonder what your experiences of undertaking the work taught you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the kind words. That's one of the major issues I have with a lot of these social epidemiological studies that we see around. And it is easy for me to complain about poor designs when we have such great data in Sweden, and we're able to identify. So in Sweden, we have something called the multi-generation register, where we can identify all individuals who were residents in Sweden, essentially practically all of them from 1932 and onwards, with their biological and or adoptive parents across time. And that allows us to identify and to generate these familial pedigrees, and so we can do a lot of interesting family-based research designs, looking at sibling comparisons and half-sibling comparisons and cousin comparisons and so on. And now also, this rich data also allows us to look at within individual factors. The problem I have with most of the studies in social epidemiology and similar fields is that they only focus on measured confounders. And we know from a bunch of different studies now that measured confounders are not adequate in addressing confounding. We have a lot of unmeasured confounding. We know that most traits, if not all, are to a varying degree heritable. And it doesn't mean that everything is due to heritable factors. It's just that a large proportion of the variation in a lot of the traits that we're interested in, ranging from all the psychiatric disorders to residence in deprived areas and income, etc., are to some extent explained by heritable factors. And it's not simple to just use measured confounders in a statistical model to account for such differences. And, you know, what usually happens in best case scenario is that people can add some information about the family history of, let's say, a psychiatric disorder. But we've shown in our different studies that that is a very poor measure of confounding. So, for instance, we had this paper looking at the associations between neighbor deprivation, but also urbanicity on schizophrenia and depression. And what we found there was that on the population level, we found strong associations similar to what other epidemiologists have found. And in the next step, in the second model, we compared differentially exposed cousins. And cousins are interesting because they share 12.5% of their co-segregating genes. But in Sweden, they typically don't tend to live in the same areas, and especially not in the same households. So what you're really capturing there is mostly a small proportion of the genetic differences there. And what we found when we did that was that the effects were essentially attenuated by half. So just by controlling for the differences between differentially exposed cousins. So one cousin lived in a more affluent area, the other one in a relatively deprived area, and then you compared these cousins within each families. And there we saw that the effects were attenuated by half. Then we did the same thing with siblings. So for instance, if you measure, so if you have a family with two children, the first child turns 15 years of age, you measure where they live, a few years pass, the family moved to a different area, the second child turns 15, and then you compare these siblings. And when you do so, you compare them, and by the comparison, you account for all the factors that they share. So 50% of their co-segregating genes and all of the other early life environmental factors to the extent that they share them. And what we found in that study then, in that part, was that there were no statistically different risks to develop schizophrenia or depression in these children who lived in different types of areas. So this approach suggested that the associations were fully confounded. And in the sensitivity analyses, we tried to account for family history instead of doing these cousin and sibling comparisons. And when we included information on the family history, the point estimates barely changed. So if you have family history and you ask individuals or you have data on whether any of their first degree relatives suffer from the same psychiatric condition that you're examining, you will only capture the tip of the iceberg of their genetic risks. So it would be equivalent of trying to adjust for income, but then have a binary measure comparing the top 1% of the income distribution with the rest. And that's not particularly interesting in most cases. Mm. So we need to get the full range of differences for it to be meaningful. And that's what we're trying to do with the family-based research designs, or in this case, with the prisoners, using a within individual design to get rid of the unmeasured confounding. And, you know, all these, and you will probably see in other papers that they use other types of what they call causal models, such as the propensity score matching techniques and so on. But that's also based on measured confounders. You're trying to make the risk groups as similar to one another by using measured confounders. That doesn't take into account the unmeasured confounders that we're trying to focus on in our studies.
It's a slightly depressing picture of observational epidemiology, isn't it? What do we take from this?
That we need to consider unmeasured confounding much more seriously than we have previously, and trying to get better data.
It's easy for you to say this, working in Stockholm with this data set.
Yeah.
So where does it leave researchers and methodologists elsewhere in the world who have to make do with less good data?
Well, it can be taken as it is a little gloomy in one sense, but it's that old canard, you know, it's science shows you the world as it is, not as you want it to be. And I think it can only push people into improving their design. I think there's no way around this.
I mean, would you just trying to think of how pharmacoepidemiology would look like if we adopted the same principles? I mean, would you trust the study that just looks at individuals who by themselves purchase different types of drugs and then follow them up and then have some form of a family history measure included in the model? That wouldn't work.
No.
Because we know that the confounding factors are so much are so influential there. And it's the same with socioeconomic status. You can't just assume that it's pretty much random. You can't assume that people become poor on a basis of a random process, which is essentially conditional on the variables that they've included in their models. That's what they're assuming.
Yeah. I guess it strikes me as a really game-changing comment, though, because a lot of what we know, or we think we know, about what causes mental illness comes from that kind of epidemiological work that you're questioning the validity of. So, you know, the link, as you say, the link between urban living and mental illness, which is something that is very well reported and, you know, has become part of our kind of general knowledge about severe mental illness. You're not necessarily saying that that isn't an important link, but you're kind of questioning that quite significantly. So I wonder how much of what we know is questioned as a result of this.
Yeah, that's one of the I think that's probably going to be the next step in epidemiology, trying to replicate the findings using more robust research designs.